Okay, 8 o'clock having arrived. I'm going to call the April 22nd, 2020 Taxes Committee to order under House Rules 10.01. So, members, just some reminders before we get going today that if you want to be recognized, text Committee Administrator Nathan Jessen, and this is for a question or a comment, whatever. He will then instruct me who's on the list. I will recognize you. Unmute your phone, that's **. And then when you are speaking, turn off your speakerphone. And also during roll calls and that, when the phones will be unmuted, please no background noise. Try to keep that down as much as possible. Also, you should have with you a number of documents that you can refer to during the meeting. There was two emails sent out by Committee Administrator Jessen, and the first one was Tuesday at 12:09. So if you're like me, you've got a mess of emails sitting there, and sometimes it's tough to find which one you're looking for. But this one was Tuesday, 12:09, and you should have had six documents attached. There was a hearing logistics, and on that hearing logistics, the CA, Committee Administrator Jessen's phone number is in the second paragraph. So, and also all of these documents other than the hearing logistics are available to the public. So the second one on that first email you got should be the federal update on the first Coronavirus Response Act. Then you should have the April 22nd agenda. The fourth one was a memorandum of the CARES Act. A fifth document was that federal update from the Further Consolidated Appropriation Act of December 20th, 2019. That's the one we actually had a hearing on, so you've seen those numbers before. And then the sixth document attached on that was the April 8th, 2020 committee minutes. And then a second email that went out yesterday, Tuesday at 3:29 p.m. from Committee Administrator Jessen, had two attachments. And one was the Department of Revenue's response to the COVID-19. And the second one was the Department of Revenue's preliminary revenue estimates for the CARES Act. Those are just some of the documents you should have. So this time we're going to take the roll. And so, Ms. Griska, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Marquardt?
Present.
Representative Lislegard?
Present.
Representative Davids?
Present.
Representative Becker Finn? Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
Representative Brand?
I am here.
Representative Andrew Carlson?
Here.
Representative Lyndon Carlson?
Present.
Representative Erickson? Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Fabian?
Present.
Representative Gomez?
Present.
Representative Lesh?
Present.
Representative Lean? Representative Lean?
Present.
Representative McDonald?
Present.
Representative O'Neill?
Present.
Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Schumacher? Representative Schultz?
Present.
Representative Swedzinski?
Present.
Representative Zhang? Representative Zhang? Representative Joachim? Representative Joachim?
Present.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Zhang. We do have a quorum.
Thank you very much. We do have a quorum, so we're going to move to number two, approval of the minutes. And Representative Les Legarde moves approval of the April 8th, 2020 minutes. And does anyone have any comments on those minutes? So I'll wait just a few seconds here. If you want to text Committee Administrator Jetson with any comments on the April 8, 2020 minutes. All right, I don't see any comments.
Mute.
So what we're going to do is we're going to unmute everyone, and we're going to vote on the yeas and the nays on the April 8th, 2020 minutes. So all those in favor of the April 8th, 2020 minutes, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say nay. The motion does prevail. The April 8th, 2020 minutes are approved. Very good. So now I think
you have been muted. To unmute yourself, press the star key twice.
So next on the agenda is to look at tax changes with state implications in the Federal CARES Act. And as Mr. Williams and Ms. Templin goes over this, it's worthy to note that the Senate yesterday passed yet another stimulus package of about $484 billion, and about $310 billion of that is the Paycheck Protection Program, adding another $310 billion to that. And the House is expected to vote on Thursday, and the governor is expected to sign that. So we have a bit of a moving target as we go through this, and this stimulus package that will be passed this week, I'm sure, will not be the last one. So with that, Mr. Williams, Ms. Templin, if you would talk about which documents you are referring to, and then I'll have you go over those. And then, members, if you have questions or comments, if you would text City Administrator Jessen, and then who your question would be directed towards. So, very good. So, if you would please proceed.
Chair Marquardt and members, this is Sean Williams from House Research. Just want to make sure everyone can hear me.
We can.
So, I'm going to be working off of the document that's labeled CKSW 420. And that's a memo that Mr. Klayman and I put together describing some of the federal provisions in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act and the Federal CARES Act that would affect Minnesota liability if the state were to conform to them. I'm going to start by talking about the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. That is at the bottom of page one of the memo. Typically, federal tax credits don't really have any effect on state liability because they don't affect either FTI for corporate franchise taxpayers or FAGI for individual income taxpayers. However, there's a tax credit in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that does have a state effect. There's actually two tax credits in the federal act for employers that provide qualified sick leave or qualified paid family leave to their employees. I'm not going to go into detail about the requirements in the act as to what sorts of leave employers have to provide, but these tax credits, I'm going to focus on those a little bit more. The reason that these credits would affect state liability in this case is they're a 100% credit for amounts that the employers pay toward sick or family leave. They have some limitations on them, but because they're 100% credits, the federal act wants to make sure that employers aren't getting more than 100% of the benefit of the leave that they're paying. So typically, an employer can deduct wages paid to individuals as a business expense. And so the federal act requires businesses or employers that claim these credits to add the amount of credit to their gross income. And by adding the amount of the credit to the gross income, they offset the deduction for the wages. And so then they just end up with a credit equal to 100% of the amount of leave paid. So that's the reason that credit in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act would affect state liability if we were to conform to it. If there are no more questions about that one, I'm going to move on to the section of the memo. It's on page two. It's talking about the CARES Act. It's starting with the section labeled individual provisions. There's a few provisions that affect individual income taxpayers in the CARES Act. So there's a provision relating to withdrawals of retirement plans. This is somewhat similar to some of the provisions that were in the disaster tax bills that we heard in this session. They allow taxpayers to take a penalty-free distribution from their retirement accounts of up to $100,000. And that affects FAGI because the income is then spread over the 3 years beginning with the distribution. The bill also allows taxpayers to take an above-the-line charitable contribution deduction, so that's for individual income taxpayers. Because that deduction is above the line, it affects FAGI. It's for cash contributions only, and it's limited to $300. That charitable contribution deduction is not for cash contributions only, but the next section of the bill, there's federal limitations on charitable contributions. So under current law federally, you are limited to 60% of AGI in the amount of charitable contributions you can make. And the bill suspends that 60% AGI limitation for cash contributions only. So in theory, you can make a cash contribution in excess of 60% of AGI and claim that as an itemized deduction for charitable contributions. And lastly, there's an exclusion from gross income for employer payments on employee student loans. As for up to $5,250 in such employer payments, and because that's an exclusion from gross income, it would affect FAGI and affect state liability. I'm going to talk briefly now about some of the business provisions in the CARES Act. Sort of the largest of these provisions that's kind of unknown right now relates to the Paycheck Protection Act loans that Representative Mark Ward discussed earlier. So typically discharged debt is counted as income. The CARES Act contains a provision that specifically excludes forgiven loans from gross income. But until Minnesota conforms to that exclusion, those loans would be considered gross income for Minnesota purposes. And I think this template is going to talk about how that's going to be handled from a revenue estimation and forecasting perspective. But I would just note that when the program ran out of money last week, the SBA reported that about $9 billion in loans had been distributed to Minnesota businesses. So if you start applying a 7% marginal rate to that, you can start to get some sense of the magnitude of how much revenue this would be potentially. And I would also note that the, and Ms. Semblin will talk about this in more detail, that the, this loan forgiveness provision was not included in the revenue estimate that was distributed to you. The CARES Act also contains a provision relating to charitable contributions for C corporations. So under current law, the contributions of a C corporation are limited to 10% of taxable income, and the CARES Act increases that limit to 25%. And there is a similar limit in current law for charitable contributions of food inventory that's 15% of taxable income for C corporations, and the CARES Act increases that also to 25% of taxable income. There's also in the CARES Act an employee retention credit, and this is for businesses that either have to shut down because of an order from a governmental authority or who experience significant declines in gross receipts. And this is a similar provision to the one that I mentioned earlier in the Families First Act, in that it's a credit, so it doesn't typically affect state liability. But the CARES Act contains a provision that essentially limits the ability of corporations to deduct wages that are used to claim the credit. So because there's a limitation on that business, that deduction is a business expense, Minnesota would not pick up the credit itself, but we would pick up that limitation on the deduction for wages. The next provision is the net operating losses provision. So the CARES Act allows losses that were generated in 2018, 19, and 20 to be carried back for 5 years. Essentially, this is one of those base Brodner provisions that was in the TCJA that we conformed to last session. And this effectively suspends the limitation on net operating losses that was put in place under TCJA until 2021. TCJA also considered or incorporated a limitation on the extent to which pass-through businesses can offset non-business income with business losses, and the CARES Act also delays that provision until 2021. So that's a provision that we conform to in the tax bill last year, and so if we were to conform to this provision in the CARES Act, we would be sort of delaying implementation of that limitation until 2021. Similarly, the TCJA put a limitation on the deductibility of business interest. That was the limit in the TCJA is 30%, and we conformed to that in last year's tax bill. And so the CARES Act would increase that limit to 50% for tax years 2019 and 2020. And it also stipulates that businesses can use their 2019 income to determine the limit for 2020. And there's a final provision that's kind of somewhat minor that Mr. Klayman referred to in the last committee hearing as a retail glitch. I think it has a substantive effect, so I don't know if this is exactly a technical change, but I think that it was an unintended effect of the original TCJA. And the TCJA disallowed certain improvements to real property for qualifying from 100% bonus depreciation as qualified improvement property. So the CARES Act retroactively treats that property as 15-year property, which allows it to qualify for bonus depreciation. So the CARES Act, and that's another provision that would expand expensing. So it's mostly a timing provision, but it would affect state liability if we were to conform. And that pretty much wraps up all the provisions that I was going to discuss, Chair Markwart, but I'm happy to answer member questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. We do have one question. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Williams. So I just have a couple of questions. I'm trying to understand the operating loss provisions. So it seems like some of these modifications to, for example, to net operating losses, like under the TCJ, the base broadening efforts were sort of like a trade-off for a really significant cut in the corporate franchise tax rate. You know, I think it was like from 35% to 21% or something, as I recall. So I guess I'm just like interested in what the sort of argument is for doing this when we already have like $1 trillion, a tax cut that is going to, you know, that's going to cost $1 trillion over, I think it was 10 years or something, with all of that benefit going to corporations and upper income earners, this sort of looks like undoing one of the small kind of concessions or one of the small exchange things that we got in exchange for such a significant tax break. So, I mean, I guess that's sort of a statement, but I'm trying to understand, you know, most of these provisions included in the CARES Act apply to tax year 2020. A couple of them apply to tax year 2019, but I'm wondering if you can talk about why this one includes 2018, 2019, and 2020. And then when you look at the five-year carryback, which was eliminated under the TCJA, if you go back from 2018, for example, then you're in tax year 2013, which is before the TCJA was adopted in 2017. And so that tax year, you know, the corporate franchise rate in 2013 through 2017 would be 35% instead of the 21%. And so I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about that interaction of, you know, kind of taking this back into the pre-TCJA tax rate and what impact that has on, our collections, if that makes sense.
So, Representative Gomez, I guess before Mr. Williams wants to address this, so I think the three main areas you're talking about is the net operating losses now can go back 5 years, and then the excess loss kind of limit was taken off, and then the interest deduction went from 30% to 50%. So the thing to remember is that all of those things that were passed in the CARE Act are all temporary, just basically through tax year 2020, and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changes are permanent into the future, just to kind of remember that. And I think the main point probably is what the federal government is looking at is, you know, kind of cash flow and some of these things to get companies and businesses kind of over the bridge during this COVID-19. But, Mr. Williams, is there anything else you want to add to that?
Chair Markford and Representative Gomez, it's hard to characterize the intentions behind or the policy intentions or the reasoning that Congress had for choosing these particular provisions. But I think that, as you were indicating, there was a general intention to give businesses some economic support given the current situation, and also to sort of stimulate aggregate demand and provide economic stimulus. And so I think by going retroactively to multiple recent tax years, you allow it to sort of more money to get out the door to some of these businesses that are facing economic hardship. You know, it's hard to know exactly why these provisions were chosen, but I think that might be some of the rationale.
Representative Gomez, follow up.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about a pass-through entity that's like the $250,000 offset limit for pass-through entities and suspending that temporarily. And can you just sort of tell me about a theoretical kind of tax return that would use that? Like what's that individual's like situation, you know, who's a pass-through entity that's offsetting more than $250,000 of income with a net operating loss?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Markward, Representative Gomez, my understanding is it would be someone operating a business that has a large loss in a particular tax year, and it could be really any business that experienced a business loss, as long as it was operated as a pass-through business. And I believe the limitation is actually $500,000 in losses for married couples filing joint returns. And you could offset use that business loss to offset either passive income or wage income. So essentially non-business income.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that couple would have to be making, if they would be well in the top 1% of income earners if they had more than 500 grand in income to offset via, like, with a net operating loss, right?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Warden, Representative Gomez, I'm not sure exactly where on the income distribution $500,000 would fall for a married couple, but I think it's accurate to say that's a higher income filer in Minnesota.
Representative Gomez.
Okay, thanks, you guys.
Yep, thank you. Also, Representative Schumacher has joined the meeting, so welcome. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Mark Ward. I have a question about the Paycheck Protection Program. So my understanding is that program was, the incentive was to retain your employees, and a lot of that money will go to pay their wages. So if we don't conform to the legislation, much of the forgivable loans will be paid out in wages. So we wouldn't be taxing that income because they'll be deducting the wages. Is that correct, Mr. Williams?
Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, your Chairman of our board and members, the math on that is somewhat complicated. The PPP program, I believe the number is that 75% of the loan amount has to be spent on wages, and then the remaining 25% could be spent on things like rent, mortgage interest, or utilities. And to the extent that the amount that the business receives sort of meets those criteria, the debt would be forgiven. The business would have the ability to claim a deduction as a business expense for the amounts that the business spent on payroll, rent, mortgage interest, and those sorts of things. But this sort of provision would deal with whether or not the loan forgiveness itself is counted as income. So to the extent it was, if you think of those wages as things that the business has to pay anyways, you know, arguably, exclusion would not sort of, I guess what I'm saying is if the business has to pay the wages or some of those other costs no matter what, then it's not necessarily the case that the wages or rent or utilities would directly offset the income as a business expense deduction. But if the business is able to pay for those expenses only because of this loan, then presumably they would be partially offsetting the income by deducting those items as a business expense.
So, Mr. Williams, if on that Paycheck Protection Program, if the loan is forgiven, typically a discharged debt is normally taxable, but the CARES Act excludes these from gross income. But when it moves to the Minnesota side, this would be included as gross income. Is that what we're talking about here, is the kind of the discharged or forgiven debt or the loan, Mr. Williams?
Chair Markward and members, that's correct. And so I think that the best way to think of it is that generally forgiven loans are taxable. So the loans that are forgiven through this program would typically be taxable. If Minnesota, the CARES Act includes an exclusion for gross income for that loan forgiveness, but Minnesota has not yet conformed to that exclusion from gross income that's in the CARES Act. So until Minnesota conforms, presumably, the discharge debt would be taxable.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So it looks like this revenue will be included in the MAKE forecast by the Department of Revenue. Does that mean the entire $9 billion, the tax of that, will be included in the MAKE forecast? Or is that the amount of the forgivable loan? If it's $9 billion, it might be less. Or is it after their deductions treated as income? So my question is, what will be in their MAKE forecast? assuming, I guess the department is assuming that we won't conform.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt and Representative Schultz, I might defer to Ms. Templin to talk about how that the forecast is going to treat some of this income. I would just note that for Minnesota's purposes, those businesses would be allowed to deduct the payroll, the rent, the mortgage interest, and utilities, whether or not the state conformed. And so presumably that part of this wouldn't be included in the forecast to the extent that this allows them to pay those things. But I'd let Ms. Templin just characterize that in more detail.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, this is Cynthia Templin. I'm just pausing to see if you can hear me first.
We can.
Okay, very good. Members, I just want to have you pull up the two revenue estimates that I'll be working off. The first one is the CARES Act, and I will go through that estimate first. It is labeled Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. And at the top of that document, it is stamped preliminary estimate.
Ms. Templin, before you go on, could you first, before you go on with your going over the revenue estimates, could you answer Representative Schultz's question first? Was on the Paycheck Protection Program, how will that be shown in the May budget update?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, yes, to that question, the currently the Paycheck Protection Program and loan forgiveness, it was not included in the February forecast. However, when the Minnesota Management and Budget releases a revised budget estimate for the fiscal 2021 biennium, the estimate will pick up the Federal Stimulus Act. And included in that will be the Paycheck Protection Program. So when we do receive a budget estimate, that the Paycheck Protection Program will be, that will show up on a revenue estimate as a revenue gain. And the amount that will show up is the amount that revenue assumes. They will have to assume a percentage of that loan that is forgiven. It may be 80% or 90%, and they will also have to assume kind of a taxable rate, a marginal rate that will be applied to that. You know, it could be 7%, for example. And that calculation will determine the additional tax liability that they will estimate that will could be a potential revenue gain to the state of Minnesota if Minnesota does not conform.
Very good. Representative Schultz, anything further on that?
Well, I guess I'm just concerned if that's going to be in the forecast. And if we do end up conforming, folks may think that we have more revenue coming in than we actually have. So if possible, I would like that to see that broken out in the forecast as a separate item, separate column.
Very good. And that could be a significant number. Needless to say. So, all right. Thank you, Ms. Representative Schultz. So, there's no more questions for Mr. Williams. So, Ms. Templin, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to continue, we are looking at, we will be starting with the CARES estimate. And I just want to remind members, this estimate is prepared by the Minnesota Department of Revenue Tax Research Department. And again, this estimate is preliminary, and it is based on the February forecast. It will be updated in early May when MMB revises its estimates. Just briefly, the first two pages of this estimate describe at a high level each provision and, in some cases, the effective dates of each provision. The top of page one shows the full general fund impact based on the February forecast for individual income tax and corporate tax. For fiscal 21 through 2023, which is the budget window, the cumulative general fund impact is a revenue reduction of $327 million over the budget forecast window. As you can see, about 97% of that total revenue reduction loss is in fiscal 2021. Page 3 of the revenue estimate, if you can turn to page 3, shows the itemized costs of the major or of the provisions with a general fund impact in Minnesota. There's about 8 provisions. The first couple provisions, the special rules for use of retirement funds and the above the line deduction for charitable contributions, along with the net operating, the exclusion for employer payments of student loans. I'm kind of cherry picking a couple of estimates. Those are the ones that just pertain to individual income tax. And those provisions in fiscal 2021, the sum of those provisions is about revenue loss of about $15 million in fiscal 21. The rest of the provisions on that page have to do with individual income tax that are business-related and corporate tax. I want to turn, or I want to kind of draw your attention to the provision with the largest revenue reduction, and it was discussed briefly with Mr. Williams in a little bit more detail with Representative Gomez, the net operating losses for pass-throughs. That provision has a revenue reduction of $250.3 million, and that is, as Mr. Williams and Representative Gomez pointed out, that provision has a 3-year tax impact. It is the only provision that affects 3 tax years. And this provision is the revenue reduction for individual income tax only. Minnesota does have net, or does have NOLs for corporations or corporate taxes, but they are, Minnesota has its own treatment for that, and that cost is not included in this revenue estimate. The next provision that I want to talk about that is also kind of a large, that has a large revenue reduction, is the modification of the limitation on business interests. This is near the bottom of the revenue estimate. And this has an impact over 2 tax years. The sum of the individual income tax and corporate tax revenue reduction is $57 million in fiscal 21. And then a third revenue reduction that has a fairly large impact is the modification of limitation on charitable contributions. Again, I'm jumping around on this page, on page 3, but this is the third provision from the top on that page, and that has a cumulative or the sum of that impact in fiscal 21 to both individual income tax and corporate tax is $20.1 million in fiscal 2021. I haven't talked about on a lot of these provisions. Some of these provisions do have an impact in the planning years in fiscal 22 and 23. You can see on that page the detail. The impact in fiscal 22 and 23 is much less. And in a lot of cases, it's the differences between the current law and the changes in the proposal. And that's why you see impact in the tails. And then another point about on this page, I just want to bring to your attention to, and this again was talked about in Mr. Williams' testimony, is there is a revenue raiser on in this bill to the state of Minnesota, and it is the employer retention credit for employee retention credit for employers affected by COVID. And this, the sum of the revenue gained for this provision to individual income tax and corporate tax is $24.9 million, and this is one time only in fiscal 21. And historically, DOR does not score federal tax credits, but based on the size of the credit and the fact that it cannot be deducted, it has an indirect effect of increasing FAGI or Minnesota's tax liability. So conforming to this provision would increase Minnesota liability by $24.9 million in fiscal 21. So the bottom line, turning your attention to the bottom line, the total general fund impact in the fiscal 2021 biennium is a revenue reduction of $317.6 million and a revenue loss of $9.4 million in the 2022 biennium, 22-23 biennium. And again, this is a preliminary estimate. It will be rescored in early May when MMB revises the budget estimates for the fiscal 22-23 biennium. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. I also want to cover the second revenue estimate, and that is the families first coronavirus response estimate, and that estimate is also stamped preliminary. And this is the credit for paid sick leave and paid family and medical leave. And again, historically, Minnesota doesn't score federal tax credits, but because of the size of this, DOR had indicated that this is not something they could ignore because this provision is not deductible, so it has the effect of increasing Minnesota tax liability. So the sum of the revenue gains to the state of Minnesota is $43.6 million in fiscal 21 only. And so on that note, I've talked a lot about how these estimates are preliminary, and I just want to remind members again that MMB announced last week that they'll be re-estimating selected tax revenues and expenditures for fiscal 20 and 21 only. This will not be an official forecast, and it will not include new estimates for the planning years, fiscal 22 and fiscal 23. But based on testimony from the state economists, this re-estimate is intended to provide kind of a rough direction of the budget for the current biennium using newer data. MMB will be updating the following funds, the general fund, the healthcare access fund, the legacy funds, and transportation funds. Major revenues that will be re-estimated are income tax, sales tax, corporate tax, alcohol tax, lawful gambling taxes, and transportation taxes. On the expenditure side, MMB has indicated that they will re-estimate DHS forecasted programs and that federal funds may be included too. The target release date for this revised budget estimate is May 5th. So with that, many revenue estimates will need to be revised with the new budget update and when the CARES So these estimates that you have before you for the federal update, they will be revised as well. And we expect that the PPP, the Payment Protection Loan Forgiveness Program, will also be included in the revised estimate. Members, feel free to contact me if you have any questions that are not answered via email, if I can follow up in any way. And that concludes my testimony.
Ms. Templin, thank you so much. I don't have any questions for you. I do have one question for Mr. Williams. So as Ms. Templin was going over those revenue estimates, we could see the pass-through, the NOL revenue estimate for pass-throughs, but we did not see a revenue estimate for corporations. Why was that?
Chair Markward and members, Minnesota has its own kind of state rules for net operating losses, and it has its own state laws for corporate net operating losses in particular. And so when we conform to some of the changes in the CARES Act, the changes for net operating losses would apply to pass-through businesses only, and Minnesota's existing state rules for C corporations would continue to apply. So there would be no effect. And you may remember during the conformity conversations last year, Minnesota picked up some revenue from treating net operating losses or placing a limitation on corporate net operating losses that kind of mirrors federal treatment. But when we did so, we put that limitation in state law rather than just picking up the federal treatment. So the sort of suspension of those limitations under the CARES Act for C corporations would not apply for Minnesota purposes.
Very good. Well, Mr. Williams, Ms. Templin, thank you so much for your presentations. Lots of really, really good information. And with a new federal stimulus package coming down the road, we may revisit this yet before the end of session, which is 26 days away. So thank you very much. We're going to move to item number four, Department of Revenue presentation on action taken in response to COVID-19. And we have Mr. Doty here from the Department of Revenue. Mr. Doty, welcome. If you would identify yourself.
First, before I start, I want to make sure you can hear me.
I can. We can.
All right. Thank you. And thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Markhorn and committee. My name is Robert Doty, and I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Before I get started, I also want to acknowledge my colleague, Joanna Bayers, our legislative director, who was also on this call and will help me and assist with any questions that that you may have as we conclude our presentation. So with that, really, before I also get started, I also just want to thank Chair Markhorn and the committee for this opportunity to update you on how the department has responded to COVID-19, which is truly an unprecedented issue. We have heard from businesses, individual taxpayers, preparers, local governments, legislators, and other professionals about what services and relief are needed during this crucial time. We have been able to take a number of steps to provide relief for businesses and individuals while weighing our responsibility to provide funding to the state and local governments to combat COVID-19. Commissioner authority to provide penalty and interest abatement. The department has been able to act in the last month to provide relief for taxpayers through existing authority to abate additional tax charges, as well as penalty and interest related to late filing and payment. Where we have been able to, we have provided grace periods for specific tax types or taxpayer situations. This allows taxpayers to pay at a later date than the due date without having to pay penalty or interest. For other taxpayers impacted by COVID and not covered by a grace period, we are still able to abate penalty and interest charges on a case-by-case basis. We have added information to our website and sent out information by Gov Delivery to respond to the questions we have been receiving from the case-by-case abatement process. Since every taxpayer situation may be unique, we have added guidance about the circumstances when abatement may be granted due to COVID-19. Abatement on a case-by-case basis. We ask that taxpayers pay their tax liability on the original due date if they can. If they are financially unable to make the payments, taxpayers may ask us to abate or reduce penalties, additional tax, and interest for late filing or payment if they have a reasonable cause or are negatively affected by the COVID-19 emergency. The types of circumstances that may support a request for an abatement include the taxpayer cannot take care of affairs for a time because they or a member of their immediate family becomes seriously ill. Secondly, a taxpayer becomes unable to pay debts as they become due because they have a significant loss of income. Thirdly, a taxpayer loses their job or their business must close, which makes paying the tax an undue hardship. And finally, the taxpayer has a significant interruption in their business or employment and cannot manage it with insurance or other financial resources. Now, when granting an abatement, the department will also consider the following. Has the taxpayer had a history of filing and paying their taxes on time? Does the taxpayer make any partial payments of tax on or near the due date? And does the taxpayer pay any underpayment of tax as soon as they are financially able to, or become aware of the underpayment? Taxpayers may request this relief after they are officially notified of a penalty. Grace periods for specific deadlines and tax types. As we are able, we have announced grace periods for a few tax types. We make these decisions understanding of the need to balance the interests of our customers and their need to retain revenue, and state and local governments' need to continue to provide essential services. A grace period means the department will not assess penalty or interest if a payment is late, as long as it is made by the end of the grace period. The following information is also included in the handout that was posted with the hearing announcement. The department granted a grace period allowing additional time until July 15, 2020, for taxpayers to file and pay their 2019 Minnesota individual income tax without any penalty and interest. Secondly, the department granted a grace period allowing additional time to pay sales and use taxes for the February and March periods for businesses identified in Executive Order 2004. So what that means is that February monthly filers that had payments originally due March 20 now have until May 20th. Secondly, that also means that March monthly and quarterly filers that had payments originally due April 20th now have until May 20th as well. Finally, the department also granted a 60-day grace period for Minnesota Care monthly and quarterly estimated tax payments that were originally due April 15, 2020. These payments are now due June 15, 2020. Deadline extension. For certain tax types, the department is able to grant deadline extension. Upon taxpayer request, the department has granted a 60-day extension of the lawful gambling tax deadline for payments originally due on Friday, March 20th, 2020, and Monday, April 20th, 2020, if needed due to COVID-19. Businesses and nonprofit organizations with a monthly lawful gambling tax payment that previously requested a deadline extension for their March payment now have until May 20th, 2020 to make that payment. Organizations that would like to request a grace period for their April payment must do so by April 27, 2020. Estimated payment calculation. We are aware that many taxpayers rely on their 2019 tax liability to compute the safe harbor for 2020 estimated income tax payments. For certain taxpayers, the first estimated income tax payment for tax year 2020 was due April 15th. Taxpayers that take advantage of the federal extension to file their 2019 tax returns may have concerns about how to determine Minnesota estimated income tax payments for tax year 2020. We consider feedback from the preparer community and taxpayers in order to develop guidance on how taxpayers can calculate their 2020 estimated income tax payments. Recognizing that some individuals, fiduciaries, and flow-through businesses may not have completed their 2019 return yet, we have added another option to calculate estimated payments for 2020 using 2018 actual tax liability. This information is also included in today's handout. So to avoid penalty, interest, or additional tax charges, taxpayers must calculate their 2020 estimated income tax payments using one of the following options. First, use either 90% of estimated tax liability in 2020. Secondly, 100% of actual liability in 2019, and that would be 110% for individuals if your AGI was more than $150,000. Or finally, 75% of actual liability in 2018. Debt collection. We know that Minnesotans are facing economic challenges at this time. This may be especially true if they are already working with us on tax debt or debt owed to another agency. If Minnesotans are experiencing financial hardship due to COVID-19 and are concerned about paying their tax debt or other agency debt, we urge them to contact us. We may be able to help modify payments or debts based on need. I want to just kind of shift a little bit to kind of give you a bit of a department update relative to COVID-19. I want to let you know that the department is continuing its work. As I mentioned, the current tax filing season is still open. So here's an update on the status of individual income tax return filing. So we have received over 2 million returns and processed 93% of those returns. As compared to last year's filing season, we have received about 70% of the returns that we expect to receive by the end of this filing season. This represents about 450,000 less returns than we have received at this same point, the same time last year. We have processed and sent over 1.5 million individual income tax refunds. Our in-person services. Our St. Paul office is temporarily closed to protect the health of our customers and employees. However, we are providing a self-service station with request forms, pens, and envelopes. Customers can ask us to mail forms and instructions, request additional tax information, order copies of previous state tax returns, and submit state tax returns or payments. Agency operations. Nearly all Minnesota Department of Revenue employees have been working from home since the governor's stay-at-home order began on March 27th. Our partners at Minnesota IT Services quickly supply needed technology. Currently, fewer than 80 employees are required to be physically at their work location in order to perform their job. These employees are maintaining proper social distancing and other public health measures while at work. Department employees are continuing to answer phone calls, emails, and mail, and process returns and other filings. We have been working with members of the legislature to address constituent issues and provide information and revenue estimates as you continue your legislative work. We know that ready access to information and transparency are important. We are continually updating our COVID-19 website with additional information to respond to taxpayer questions. We have FAQs, the most up-to-date information on tax deadlines, abatement information, and we also link to IRS resources, specifically those on the federal economic stimulus payment. Taxpayers, preparers, and members of the public can also sign up for our Gov Delivery to get updates sent right to their inbox. We have nearly 400,000 unique subscribers, and it really is the best way for us to communicate directly with our customers. Whether working in an office or remotely, the same high standards for protecting customer information are still in place. So in closing, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I definitely want to thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony this morning about how the department is responding to COVID-19. Myself and our legislative director, Joanna Bayers, are now available for any questions that you may have.
Mr. Doty, thank you so much for that presentation. I have a question for you before we open it up to members. But you had listed a number of reasons kind of that people would have for, you know, financial hardship, and they could go then to the Department of Revenue and looking for some, you know, relief or, you know, penalty abatement or whatever that might be. Could you share that list of reasons with the committee at some time? So we had that where you listed, you know, you have a sick member in the family, or, you know, you had an interruption in income or whatever those reasons you had listed. Could you share those with the committee?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. So the reasons that I listed here were, first of all, if a taxpayer cannot take care of their affairs for a time because they or a member of their immediate family becomes seriously ill. Secondly.
You don't have to repeat that, but if you could, on what you passed out here that we have in documents for our committee, we don't have what you just were going to say there and you had mentioned earlier. Could you send that out to committee members so we could see that? So as we're talking to constituents and so forth, we would have that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I'm sorry. Yeah, I will definitely make sure we do that.
All right. Very good. And then I see there's a couple phone numbers on the bottom of what you passed out, and the public should have this also. Are those the best phone numbers? What's the best way if there is a business that has a question either on 2020 estimated taxes or whatever that might be, what is the best, most efficient phone number for them to call?
The numbers that are on the bottom there are the best numbers to call, or even easier to go to our website, to the COVID-19 page. There's a lot of information there, but those numbers are good numbers, and we are checking those constantly to make sure that we're answering taxpayer questions.
All right. Thank you so much. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the hearing today. Mr. Doty, you talked a lot about different abatements and so forth. The biggest question that I'm getting right now and the largest concern that I'm hearing about from businesses has to do with May 15th coming up and property taxes due. And property taxes are complicated, I understand that, but my question is what kind of communications has Revenue had with the counties with regards to the payment of the state general tax and the collection of that? I've got some constituents that would like to see that waived or abated or whatever. And I recognize that lump sum payment that goes in the first half, you know, goes into the counties, and then they distribute it out to the different entities. But where are we at with regards to property taxes that Revenue collects through the counties?
Mr. Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to defer that to my colleague, Joanna Bayers.
Ms. Bayers, welcome. If you would identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bayers. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, to answer your question, we've been in partnership with the counties throughout this process. We understand the property tax piece is a local decision that each county are making. Nothing specific has been addressed when it comes to the state general levy. We know that there was a bill, I think, that you all heard regarding settlement dates, but we haven't, done any acting or have made any decisions about the state general levy.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Bayers, I'm curious to know, you haven't made any decisions, but what conversations are you having internally with regards to, so for example, and Chair Marquardt, I sent you the text message with that property tax statement. I have a local business. Their property value is on, it's on a motel, and they're running at about 10 to 20% occupancy, and it's been that way for, what, 6 weeks now or more? And the state general tax on that statement is a little over $9,000, so the first half is going to be about $4,500, a little bit more than that. The counties can waive fees and interest, penalties and interest, I understand that. But when does the state expect payment for the general levy from the counties? And I'm just, so what I'm getting at is, can we give, you know, we've heard a lot, Mr. Chair, about tax credits and tax credits and some of these other things, but I've got a lot of small businesses that are caught in a donut hole, and they don't seem to qualify for any financial assistance, and their problem right now is cash flow. It's cash flow, cash flow, cash mm-hmm. flow, because nobody's coming through the doors. And these businesses, there's a lot of them. I've talked to some of the different mayors up here. They're concerned that between 25 and 40% of our Main Street businesses are going to close and will not reopen after this is done. And it has largely to do with customers not coming through the door and them not having cash flow to pay their taxes and pay themselves so that they can buy groceries and their employees. And so I'm looking for something that we can give these businesses so that they can keep the doors open and a year and 2 years from now they can still be providing goods and services for our main streets.
So
Mr. Chair, the question back to Ms. Bayers is,
okay,
you don't have anything in place at this point, but what conversations are you having internally that could actually help small businesses by abating the general levy that's on our local property taxes, line 8?
Ms. Bayers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the things that we have to look at is balancing the, you know, taxpayers' needs with the funds needed by the state as well. And so one of the things that we are looking at is what that would cost to do any kind of abatement or shifting of that state general levy in respect to doing anything on the property tax side.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Fabian.
So, if that were to be something that we were looking at, Ms. Bayers and Mr. Chair, does that qualify, or excuse me, does that, is that something that can be done just through the agency, taking action on, in the executive branch, or is that something that the legislature would have to do?
Representative Fabian, I think maybe the legislature may have to do that, but Ms. Bayers might have more. Is there any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, right now, the statute's really a little bit unclear, so legislation would likely be the case for that.
Now,
so, Mr. Chair,
add,
one last thing.
Yeah, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If staff could do some quick work on that for us and get the answers that we really need to have, this is not something that we can wait with a long time. We need to get moving if it's at all possible.
Very good. And I, just as kind of some information, yesterday the Hennepin County Board passed a resolution that would waive penalties for late payment of the May 15th first half property taxes until July 15th. And it was for property taxpayers who owe less than $100,000 annually and don't do escrow. And they, in the resolution, they allowed that taxpayers who owe more than $100,000 can apply for a deferred payment if they show a factual basis for waiving the penalty. So, you know, we have talked about property taxes kind of in the past, and counties do have the authority to kind of set their own policies on how that would work. And I believe they can also waive the statewide property taxes. And so, I mean, that's one county for sure that has done that. And, you know, I presume there will be more if there hasn't already been more that have passed resolutions like that. So, anyway, that's kind of a point of reference. Representative Fabian, anything more?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just hope that staff can pull a memo together for the committee members so that we can see just exactly what would be needed or required. And I appreciate the fact that there are some counties, and I know counties up here are having some conversations about that, but the sooner the better on some clarity. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks. Thank you, and we will get that. So any further? Oh, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically to that question, I just want to get a clear answer from the Department of Revenue. Do the counties have the authority to push the deadline for property tax past May 15th? I just want to be absolutely clear. I did hear them say that they can waive penalties and interest and do that sort of abatement, but I didn't hear specifically about pushing the May 15th deadline, because I'm getting flooded in my district as well with questions about the inability to pay the May 15th property tax. And so what exactly does each county have the authority to do, and what does the legislature have to do?
Right. So they cannot, counties cannot push back the May 15th deadline. But what they are doing is they're abating any late penalty payments, just like kind of the income tax approach DR is kind of taking, where they can push back the date where they would start incurring penalties. So in effect, what you're doing is delaying you know, the payment deadline for till whatever date. But no, you would, the counties cannot push back the actual deadline. They can only push back and abate late payment penalties to a certain date, which is in effect is doing the same thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is that, does that include the state general levy as well, or only the county, city, school district tax? Is it both, the whole thing?
Yes. No, that would also include the state general levy. They can,
okay,
right, so they can push all of that back. So a lot of these counties, when they're pushing these penalties back, would also be pushing back the time for the state general levy also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Petersburg.
The thing about the property tax is something we dealt with, property tax, and I think Representative Andrew Carlson talked about this too. We really do need to get that bill passed that allows the counties to distribute those funds earlier rather than if it get delayed past, gets only paid to the townships and cities and so forth at the second payment date. So we do need to deal with that, even if we do all of the other things. So just wanted to keep that in front of the committee here.
Yeah, no, Representative Petersburg, thanks so much for bringing that up. And we did hear that in the property tax division on Monday, where let's say counties do kind of delay payments to like July 15th, they still would have more flexibility in redistributing those dollars back out to the cities and the school boards and the townships before October or November, which is in state law right now. So Representative Petersburg, you're absolutely correct. I'm getting some information that currently Crow Wing, Winona, and Olmsted counties have taken action to abate penalties to a later date, and it's all till July 15th. So what we know would be Hennepin, Crow Wing, Winona, and Olmsted at this point. Members, anything, any other questions for Mr. Doty or Ms. Bears? Seeing none, Mr. Doty and Ms. Bears, thank you so much for your presentation and for your work. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And so Representative O'Neill has indicated that Pine County has also extended property tax payments. So very good. Thanks for that update. Members, anything else for the good of the order before we adjourn? I'll wait just a second or two. Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian? Oh, we couldn't hear you. Representative Fabian? Okay, you're good.
Am I good now?
You are.
Okay. So when the dollars come from the feds, if staff again could put something together for us that doesn't outline so much the tax credits at this point, I'm just wondering more about the cash that's available now to small businesses. If someone could kind of pull together a summary document that we could hand out to our constituents and say, here are some things that are available, check this out, check that out, and so forth. It would be helpful to me. We've gotten just a flood of information, and you know, Mr. Chair, how busy you have been and members have been dealing with constituent issues. If there was some sort of a summary document for small businesses, that would be very helpful if someone could do that.
Representative Fabian, that is a super idea, and you'd want not only state but the federal programs also that are available, anything that's available. Would that be right?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Yes, that would be super. Thank you. I think Matt Hilgert from the Association of Minnesota Counties is on the line. Mr. Hilgert, now that we've talked about counties and property taxes and that, is there, or maybe you're not on the line. All right, just hold on a second. We do have a few minutes left here. We were so efficient, we got through done early today. We're waiting for Mr. Hilgert. Hilgert.
Should be on. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can. Mr. Hilgert, thank you.
I think I should be on.
Yes, you are on. We can hear you. And
perfect.
We're talking about counties and property tax or penalty abatement and so forth. Did you have any comments? And introduce yourself first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. The Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I appreciate it. I know that this was not planned, but I do appreciate you giving me the opportunity to address some questions here, too, and just provide a cursory overview of kind of what are the discussions taking place around the state level. The association has put out some guidance to members surrounding the statutory authorities provided in Minnesota Statutes 279 and 375 around the discussions that we've had today, which is the delay in penalties for late payments of property taxes. We've also provided some model guidance to counties on if they are considering this, what issues and questions to ask themselves, how to be talking to their fellow taxing jurisdictions or cities, townships, school districts to make sure they have the capacity, and how to be helping should there be some cash flow concerns long term. So in that, we've been doing some recent surveys to get the gist of what is going on and what members are doing. As of late last week, close to 50% of our members are in discussions with their boards about providing some form of property tax relief. And I want to put an asterisk next to that because these are discussions. It's not yet actions. You've listed about five or six counties who have taken action. That is accurate. I think there might be three or four more who have as well. But at this moment, many counties are waiting to see what the state is going to do or not do before they take further action. So many boards are delaying this action until April or even early May. So the sooner that the legislature either says counties continue doing kind of what you're doing or we're actually going to do some kind of uniform policy, the sooner that guidance comes out, I think the better for all. And the models of tax relief are a little different. They're similar in that they all are surrounding the penalty issue. No county is talking about anything aside from kind of three solutions that I've heard of, which is the delay of penalties associated with late payments. And some counties are talking about pushing it to June 15th. Some are talking July 15th, and there are some counties that are talking even longer than that, potentially to August 1st. The other model is kind of that first model with an amendment, and that is saying that, okay, counties are going to delay the penalties on late payments to, let's say, June 15th or July 15th for non-escrowed payers, as well as people who have a property tax bill under a certain amount. And the third option that we've heard of is, I believe, what is kind of being coined as the Sherburne County model, which is not moving or not doing anything with the delay in penalties, but reducing the penalties. So using authorities to reduce that penalty from, let's say, 2% to 1% for late payments. So in all, I think AMC is very proud that counties are stepping up and saying, how can we provide relief to folks? But again, when you're making these decisions, one, you want to make sure that a program is administrable and clear and transparent for taxpayers and fair and equitable. And two, you need to make sure that folks have capacity. You know, counties and cities and school districts, property tax is their main source of revenue. And, you know, the decisions that they made in December of last year on their budgets and their operations reflect the expectation that 95-98% of taxpayers are going to pay. And so if you make a decision to delay, to delay those late payments and fees, and you have a high utilization of taxpayers not paying on that May 15th date or until a July 15th, let's say, what does that do to cash flow for counties and cities and school districts, and how does that impact mandated operations? So those are some of the items that we're considering on a statewide basis.
So thank you so much, Mr. Hilgert. And I would say to you that you can send this message out to the counties that they should not expect a state mandate on property taxes. And so, you know, counties should move forward with what they're doing. As you mentioned, like, you know, the Hennepin County example, counties can set their own policies on exactly how that's going to work best for their counties, and also how they know how that's going to impact their cities and school districts and townships and so forth. So I would get that message out that counties should not expect a state mandate on property taxes.
Will do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments for the good of the order? If not, members, thank you so much. Stay glued to your emails, and everyone, please stay healthy. So with that, this meeting of the Taxes Committee is adjourned.